supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
A proposal to use city tax dollars to fund candidates for political office in Philadelphia is gaining momentum. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The City Ethics Board endorsed the idea at a public meeting today. Joining me to help make sense of this is WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. And Dave, Philadelphia politicians as a whole don't exactly have the kind of reputation that would encourage voters to throw tax dollars their way. What's the idea behind this?
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Well, you know, Dave, public financing of elections is an idea that reformers have embraced in a few places to reduce the influence of special interests and big money in campaigns. The idea is that you give deserving candidates a chance to run on their ideas with some public funding instead of spending all that time trying to court big donors, and you get better candidates, cleaner elections, and people in office who care about the public.
So how would this work in Philadelphia? Anyone who gets on the ballot gets a check from City Hall?
Not quite that simple. To qualify, you got to be on the ballot. You have to have an opponent. And before you get any public funding, you have to raise a certain threshold of contributions of $150 or less from residents of the district you're running in. So, for example, a district city council candidate would need $15,000 in those smaller contributions from citizens in his or her district. That's important. And once the candidate does that, he or she would be eligible for a 4-to-1 match of city dollars. So if you raise $15,000 that way, the match turns it into $75,000. That's nice. For a mayoral candidate to get the match, he or she would have to raise $50,000 in small contributions, again, from citizens of Philadelphia. Ethics Board Executive Director Shane Creamer told me today that will have an effect on how city candidates campaign and what they say.
You need to concentrate your message for citizens of Philadelphia if you want to get those donations that are eligible for matching. And so you're spending less time talking to the big donors that may or may not even be in Philadelphia.
So, Dave, would the system impose additional restrictions on candidates?
Yeah, and this is interesting. This is one of the ways this is supposed to help clean things up besides providing the financial assistance. If a candidate enters this public financing system in Philadelphia and gets the matching dollars, there's a limit on how much they can spend in the race. It's $2 million, for example, in a primary election. And there's also limits on what they can accept from political committees and businesses. Now, the Ethics Board staff tells me that right now they cannot constitutionally restrict anybody's spending or what they take from special interests. It's considered a violation of free speech. But in this system, the candidate voluntarily agrees to limit his or her spending in return for the help. And the hope is that will give us cleaner elections.
But in reality, wouldn't a lot of candidates just decline the public funding if it restricts their ability to tap those big donors and spend even more?
Sure, and that's always an option. But it's interesting that what we hear is that what's happening in New York, where a system like this has been in place for more than a decade, is that if candidates opt out of the public financing system, voters tend to regard them with some suspicion. It's sort of become a good government seal of approval that candidates want, and that kind of nudges them towards the system with its restrictions on fundraising and spending.
So the Ethics Board likes it. It next goes to City Hall. Are opponents lining up?
Well, sure, there will be opposition. I mean, for starters, you're talking about handing out taxpayer money to Philadelphia politicians. Like, you know, who's going to have a problem with that, right? But even if you make the case that this would be an investment in cleaner elections and better government, there's going to be a debate about the cost. You know, our Tom McDonnell caught up with Mayor Kenney today at an event and asked what he thinks about this. And he said, look, money is always tight, and his priority is funding education.
Although it's a laudable goal to want to have public financing, for me to make a decision to publicly finance an election or to fully fund our school, adequately fund our schools will always win.
Now, this will be debated. You know, the rough estimates suggest this would cost a few million dollars every 4 years when we have a mayoral election, and much less in other years. So you can make a case that it's worth it, but there's going to be a debate. There's five co-sponsors in city council out of 17 members now, but mayor isn't sold yet.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. A lawyer in the Philadelphia organization representing those who can't afford attorneys is suing the group in federal court. And as WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, The Philadelphia public defender says he was demoted after exposing that his colleague was practicing law with a suspended license.
In his federal whistleblower lawsuit, Christopher Welsh says he got this response from higher-ups when he asked about a colleague whose license had been suspended. Quote, "You better hope no one goes poking around the skeletons in your closet." Being administratively suspended as a lawyer can happen for not paying required fees or failing to complete continuing education courses. But lawyers get many warnings before the suspension happens. And as ethics lawyer Ellen Brotman says, it's a serious deal.
Once you're suspended, you're done. You cannot practice.
Brotman says it can happen if a lawyer changes addresses and misses the warning letters or is bogged down by having too many cases at once. Still, she says,
it's not the kind of thing that should happen if you're paying attention.
The unnamed offender, who was allegedly practicing without an active license, represented poor children, probably the most vulnerable defendants. The lawsuit says that representing them improperly could reopen hundreds of closed cases. But civil rights attorney Lloyd Long says the only way to have a conviction overturned is to show that the suspension caused the conviction.
I think that's a very high bar to pass.
Defender Association Chief Keir Bradford Gray calls the allegation that a defender was practicing without a license baseless.
There's always other sides to the story, but that will have to come out during the process.
Welsh's lawsuit isn't asking for money, but instead to get the job he had before getting demoted. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
In any contentious debate, getting two sides to agree to a set of facts can be an elusive, or if not frustrating, endeavor. And sometimes the more you push on facts, the more squishy they become. Keystone Crossroads' Kevin McCrory offers this example from a report this week about teacher absenteeism.
Police officers, ma'am.
Why couldn't you have got here before that big, bad, stupid-looking piece of sewage breath stole my white wedding dress?
Just the facts, ma'am.
If only it were that easy, Detective. Take, for instance, a report out this week on chronic teacher absenteeism by the Fordham Institute. It used Federal Office of Civil Rights data and found this indisputable fact. Nationwide, teachers in traditional public schools are almost three times as likely to be chronically absent as teachers in charter schools, a rate difference that holds true for Pennsylvania. David Griffith is a senior researcher at Fordham, a D.C.-based education reform think tank.
There's this big difference in teacher attendance between these two types of public schools. And it seems like there's some pretty clear links between the policies that states and districts adopt and the rates of teacher chronic absenteeism.
Another fact, Griffith notes that the gap in chronic teacher absenteeism is widest in states like Pennsylvania, where districts must go through collective bargaining with teachers, but charter schools don't have to. When examining the difference between unionized charters and non-unionized charters, a gap appears as well.
You know, in places where teachers maybe do have really high job security, it's certainly possible that, you know, that they feel more comfortable taking more sick days.
The report was funded by the Walton Family Foundation, which is in the midst of a $1 billion campaign to help charter schools expand nationwide.
People can draw their own conclusions about that. Everything you said is true. But ultimately, the numbers speak for themselves.
But are the facts everything they seem?
Telling a story with data is not the same as reaching a conclusion based on evidence. And so I think more evidence is needed to really get to the bottom of it.
Philip Serenides is an assistant professor of research at the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. He went through the same federal data set as Fordham and found some important nuances that didn't make the report. For instance, teachers that are brand new to the profession are much less likely to be chronically absent. And the data show that charters employ a much higher percentage of teachers in their first or second year compared to traditional public schools. So without that and other context considered, he doesn't put that much stock into the report.
For the conclusions in this report to really be persuasive, those differences should be incorporated into the research method so that the comparison between rates and charter and district schools is apples to apples.
In a follow-up interview, Griffith acknowledged that the study could have included more context.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true that we could have done that. We could have controlled for a lot of things, right?
The Fordham report also doesn't delve into the idea of teacher turnover, which is higher in the charter sector. But that's a fact that can be overblown by traditional public school advocates, as in recent years, the turnover rates for the different sectors have significantly narrowed. Kevin McCrory, Keystone Crossroads.
It's a familiar concern among long-standing classical arts organizations. how to stay relevant and attract new audiences while remaining true to both repertoire and longtime fans. Here are audience reactions to the experiments of one Philadelphia institution.
This certainly lends itself to bringing in more people, younger people, I think.
It is my first time, yes. I've always wanted to experience something like this. It's outside of what I normally will do for entertainment.
We've been coming since 1994. The innovations have been very important.
Opera Philadelphia has embraced the challenges of staying relevant amid evolving audience tastes and technological transitions to host its first ever opera festival. 017 is underway through the 25th of this month, featuring seven operatic happenings over 12 days in six venues across the city. David Devan was hired as the company's managing director in 2006, and he served as general director and president of Opera Philadelphia since 2011. David, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
It's great to be with you.
And it's a pleasure to speak with you while this festival is in full tilt.
Mid-stroke. We're on day six of 12, so we're literally in the midst of it.
Describe the Opera Company of Philadelphia as it was called when you first came aboard. It's been widely described as needing to have the dust shaken off.
Yeah, it was a regional-scaled opera company that had enjoyed some inconsistent bursts of health and challenge. And it was really hadn't found its way to be sustainable in its proximity to New York, where it's a major opera company, the Metropolitan Opera, and amongst the classical arts offerings in Philadelphia. And so when I got here, one of my primary concerns was to basically create a unique artistic identity for the company that would be relevant and meaningful to Philadelphia and to the artists in the genre.
And in learning about the tastes of those audiences, you didn't merely put your finger to the wind.
Yeah.
The organization resulted in some very extensive marketing.
Yeah, we're kind of data geeks. And so we unearthed some real important insights, and that opera had a lot to offer modern audiences if we were able to stimulate artists to do their best work to engage you as an audience member, and if we were to package it in a way that was consistent with people's media buying habits.
And with that, the subscription model had to go.
Well, we've actually figured out a way to have our cake and eat it too. So our festival will open each of our seasons. And as one of those festival pieces is a big opera, this time Magic Flute at the Academy of Music. Come and see it. It's fantastic. But we continue through the season with a production in February and a production in April in the Academy. So the subscribers can keep subscribing. But what it does is it allows us to attract a number of other new opera patrons within the festival. And those two categories are new to opera people. Our fastest growing segment is 25 to 34-year-olds. So we're kind of crushing the millennial demographic. And then the other are operaphiles from outside Philadelphia to make Philadelphia a destination place. And the early data is suggesting that we've been very successful on both of those fronts. And we've done a way that we haven't disassociated ourselves from our long-serving audience, which was the challenge in wiring all this together.
If artistry and performance ultimately is about connectiveness and humanity, here's a question I can likely anticipate the answer to, but we are hearing about potential cuts to arts funding from the federal government.
Yes. To
which you say?
I wrote a blog entry about that. It's not about the money. It's about saying that human expression is important. And by having a national funding entity says that this is a priority for this country, that we can communicate with each other. They've actually done scientific research and discovered that artistic expression actually led to the development of language.
Not the other way around.
Not the other way around. So our ability to communicate has its root in artistic expression. So the idea of us not wanting to make art for art's sake a priority, not as a commercial activity, is to deny our ability to communicate and our history in how we communicate as we are doing right now.
David Devan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you at the halfway point. Good luck in the final 6 days of 2017.
Thank you so much.
David Devan, General Director and President of Opera Philadelphia. Imagine having no electric bill, instead living off the sun's energy. More and more people are going solar as the price of the equipment drops, though Philadelphia has been behind on the solar boom. The city's red tape and pushback from electric utilities, combined with the lack of state incentives, have so far meant comparatively few solar rooftops in Philly. A citywide program hopes to change that. State Impact's Catalina Jaramillo reports on one young couple weighing the odds amidst a changing solar market.
Hello. Thanks for coming.
Anthony Locicero has been thinking about installing solar panels on the roof of his house since he bought it 7 years ago. It's a three-bedroom row house in South Philadelphia.
But it just never made financial sense.
Until now. A new citywide solar energy program showed him how much it will actually cost to install solar panels on his roof today.
And it was surprisingly inexpensive.
But he's getting married in October, and his fiancée, Christina George, is not that convinced.
My whole thing was, this might not be our forever home. So does it make sense to invest in this program, say, if we're deciding that we're going to move 3 years down the line? Like, what happens?
During that part of the conversation was when I learned that this may not be our forever home. So there's that. Got that going for me right now.
But Locicero still has a chance, especially if it means saving money. So they do the math. Right now, their electric bill is around $70 per month.
If we do get solar installed, our electric bill theoretically would drop to $1.66 a month.
That sounds amazing, right? But don't forget that they still need to pay for the solar panels and the installation. And even with the city's help, it's going to cost over $18,000. But here's where Locicero gets really excited. With federal tax credits, he saves another $5,000. So in monthly payments, it doesn't seem so much of a sacrifice.
At the end of the day, if we, you know, go out to lunch one less time a month, it's not, you know, making or breaking our living situation.
Locicero and George are not alone in this decision. About 1,800 residents have expressed interest in the city's program. Philadelphia's goal is to install 500 new residential solar rooftops by 2018, which it hopes will help create new green jobs. To make that happen, they had to bring the cost of solar energy down to earth. Here's how they did it. They bought solar panels in bulk, locking down a below-market price. They made a deal with three solar installers to save on labor costs. Both of these deals take advantage of economies of scale. Emily Shapira is the executive director of the Philadelphia Energy Authority, the organization running the program.
You'll already save just by being a part of Solarize Philly, not to mention the fact that the more people who sign up, the deeper those discounts get.
But given that solar installation prices are going down, is it better for people like Locicero and George to wait until the prices drop even more? Christina Simeone is an energy policy expert with Penn's Climate Center. She says waiting can be risky because there's a chance prices could actually go up.
The immediate threat is the trade case.
That's a case brought to the International Trade Commission by American solar manufacturers who are in bankruptcy. They say they can't compete with the cheap solar panels imported from China, so they're begging the federal government to set tariffs on solar imports. And even if the trade case gets dismissed, President Trump could decide to cut the federal tax credits. They're scheduled to phase out in 2019, but the president could decide to cut them sooner.
So one could theorize that people would want to lock down the price of cheap solar as soon as possible given that there might be a threat that prices go up.
To attract homeowners who are having a hard time making the decision, the city has also promised to cut through the red tape. That saves a lot of time and headaches with permit applications. Still, for Christina George, the timing is not the best. She has student loans to pay off, not to mention her upcoming wedding.
Maybe.
It's not on the top of my list of things to take on right now. So, and another expense.
Yeah.
Needless to say, I was not happy.
Right. So I've been obviously the proponent of it in the family. And yeah. So I'm, you know, I think I'm slowly turning Christina, but we'll see. We're not sure yet.
Lo Cicero does not have a lot of time. To get all the benefits of the city's deal, homeowners have to sign a contract before the end of October. Catalina Jaramillo, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.